Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review has been in for Jim Garrity all week and is again here today on Friday doing a fantastic job. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And we start with a very strong conservative figure who just doesn't happen to live in this country. But it's Daniel Hannan. He's a British member of the European Union Parliament. For now, because, of course, Britain has voted to leave the European Union, and I'm guessing that means that they won't have too many more representatives in their parliament once that's completed. But in the wake of the Brexit vote, in which voters, of course, voted to exit the European Union, Christian Amanpour of CNN was conducting a quote-unquote interview with Daniel Hannan, which was really just a badgering and a berating. But Hannan's ability to fire back in the moment instantaneously on so many different issues was fantastic. We have three clips here. A couple of them are a little bit long, but it's so worth it. First of all, Amanpour explaining that this was really just the Conservatives trying to keep different people out of Britain. It was all about immigration control.
Are you then saying that this immigration is going to be much lighter than you all promised?
I have never, ever made any commitment on numbers, ever. On the contrary,
numbers,
I have said
just on facts, no free movement of
what we said
labor.
Is we would take back control. Now, what that means is that a foreign court should no longer get to determine who can reside in this country, who can enter this country, that that should be a question for parliamentary sovereignty. We are clear about that.
So you're
that
saying, you're
it
saying
does not,
that parliamentary sovereignty could quite easily allow the same number of people to keep coming
that will
in?
Be a decision for parliament. That's how democracy works.
You have got to be kidding me. What? This whole thing was run on...
You guys have been shouting racist so long you weren't listening to what we were actually
saying. Did I say that?
And so then we get on to Amanpour saying, there's been a huge rise in hate crimes in the 2 days since the vote. Here's how that exchange went.
Are you concerned about some of the post-Brexit hate crimes, the graffiti, the hurling of insults? Are you?
Come on. That's our fault?
The Prime Minister started Parliament today with
an outrageous question. In every country, in every population...
I am asking you, as a politician, are you concerned about some of the fallout?
In every country, you have some racist idiots. In every society, you have some racist idiots. But for you to suggest without any connection that this is somehow connected to the campaign,
Daniel,
that you couldn't have had, that there were no racists in Britain before.
And then we have Christian Amanpour saying, this vote clearly means that you want nothing to do with Europe anymore, right?
You see, I thought this referendum was about disassociating from the EU.
I get that you thought that.
Yeah,
you were evidently not listening to us.
So it wasn't?
Correct.
It wasn't about disassociating from the EU.
May I tell you what it was about without interruption?
Please.
Yes. It was about an internationalist global Britain, a more deregulated Britain, a freer Britain, and a more democratic Britain, one that is interested and engaged with the affairs of every continent, including Europe.
Ian, there's so much to love about this because, first of all, it exposes Christiane Amanpour, like she needed to be exposed any further, as just being a water carrier for the EU's side of this whole discussion. At the same time, though, Hannan's ability to respond articulately, consistently and thoroughly is just amazing. Why can't we find conservatives in this country outside of maybe Ted Cruz on a good day and a couple of others who can articulately defend in the moment what they believe and do it that well?
I think it has something to do with Oxford. Hannan is an Oriel Oxford alumnus, and I notice a certain parallel with my colleague Charles Cook, also an Oxford graduate here at NR, and their debating abilities. So I think there's something maybe baked into the Oxford-Cambridge system over there. It's a great clip, and it's as you say, exposes Christian Amanpour's bias on this issue in the sense of her inability to come up with anything other than sort of the obvious talking points that were thrown at leavers in the lead up and, of course, in the wake of the vote. What's really clear is she has no idea, at least it seems. She really doesn't know who Dan Hannan is. This is a significant point. I think David Ferdoso at the Washington Examiner tweeted that it seems from the clip that she thinks this is Nigel Farage, or someone told her this was Nigel Farage, and she doesn't know the difference. And there's a very important difference. As Hannan tries to point out, you know, there was a whole spectrum of people who were engaged in the Leave effort, and it cut across various ideological lines. Hannon is most certainly at the intellectual end of that movement, a well-known journalist, as well as, of course, a member of the European Parliament, written several books, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And Hannon is also, as he sort of articulates at the end, more libertarian on certain issues than, say, you know, Farage is. If she had wanted to conduct sort of an intelligent interview, it would have helped to know at least a few basic facts about who Dan Hannon is. But she clearly didn't. She clearly sort of lumped all of Leave together as these crazy xenophobes who voted on the economic ruination of the United Kingdom, which is simply not true, and just shows in sort of a perfect crystallized form the general sentiment of so much of the liberal progressive left when it's come to this issue.
Ian, this is just more proof that I don't know if it's been as good in the David Cameron era, but Prime Minister's Questions for political nerds and political junkies is the best TV out there.
It absolutely is.
The ability to articulate, the ability to weave in the cutting insults, and the ability to actually have substantive discussions. I'm not advocating for a parliamentary system in this country, but a little more debate at that level, I think, would do us a whole lot of good.
I actually kind of think so, too. And it makes you long, to a certain extent, for the days when the House of Representatives and the Senate actually met. You had Daniel Webster and Henry Clay and the rest of them up there speechifying and sparring. And there was something healthier to that system than the speech giving over C-SPAN.
Definitely true. And of course, you always sound smarter with a British accent. So
it helps.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, on to the bad news now, the bad martini. And we have gotten, it looks like, the short list, or at least what is suspected to be the short list for Donald Trump. Sources confirming that Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who of course has been a strong Trump ally since Christie himself stopped running for president, is being vetted, as is Newt Gingrich, which is surprising no one. And I'm guessing Sean Hannity is doing a happy dance somewhere because he's been publicly shilling for this for a very long time. Another name on the list apparently is Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, who I think for most conservatives would be a far better option than Christie. He, of course, ran into some trouble with the religious freedom debate, and that sullied his star a little bit, maybe even stopped him running for president himself. Some other names out there, although there's some debate about who else is on this list, include Jeff Sessions and Bob Corker. But if, in fact, it's Christie, Ian, what does he add? He gives you no states. He's incredibly unpopular in his own state. He's essentially a Trump clone. For a guy who needs to reach out and unify the party, I'm not sure what this accomplishes, if in fact that were to be the choice.
Yeah, this is totally weird, to put it very crudely. I know that Chris Christie is good at driving the limo and just A-plus at gathering snacks for the committee meetings. I mean, I understand, you know, Chris Christie serves a purpose in the campaign right now, but I don't understand why that should elevate him to the vice presidency. You've already got a liberal Democrat on the Republican ticket. I'm not sure why you would want a sort of moderate Republican on the ticket. You would want someone, it seems, who would balance that out. As we talked about yesterday, though, Trump has seemed impervious to the need to reach out to more rock-ribbed conservatives to bring them into the fold. In that regard, Pence is actually a good choice, a sober, fairly thoughtful, generally reform-oriented conservative Republican who's done a reasonably good job in his state as a balance to the very colorful Donald Trump. Might not actually be the worst choice, although it certainly would, I think, tarnish Pence's credentials to join that ticket. So there's sort of a good and a bad there. But when it comes back to Christie, the only thing I can think, and I genuinely think this is the way that the Trump campaign works, is he's a loyal guy. Jokes aside, Trump values reflexive loyalty above everything else. And since Christie dropped his own campaign and jumped on to the Trump bandwagon, he's been willing to carry Trump's water despite the heckling and the rest. And I think Trump values that. There's just a sort of almost mafioso type. I think we've talked about this before. A sort of mafioso type structure in which Trump doesn't necessarily make political calculations. He certainly doesn't make policy calculations. He makes these more instinctual judgments about who's most loyal to him and who isn't, and then elevates accordingly. So that's the best case I can make for Christie being in that group at this point.
Well, we know that there's also the possibility, because Paul Manafort or somebody else in the campaign has said there could be still be a surprise VP candidate. And given the family taking on more of the leadership role in this campaign, I just did a quick Google search and found that both Donald Jr. and Ivanka will be 35 by Election Day. Eric would be too young, so it can't be him. But there's your surprise candidates.
The New York Strong ticket, you know, could be could be a draw. Who knows?
Well, if it is Trump Christie, and then it is Clinton Warren, which I probably don't think it'll be, but you know, kind of the cloning tickets, that would be an interesting way to go here. Basically, neither one of them actually thinking strategically, and just finding someone who's exactly like them. Okay, on to the crazy martini now, and it's 4th of July weekend, and that means apple pie and fireworks and hopefully reading the Declaration of Independence and baseball games and patriotic songs like God Bless America. And apparently the left just can't take it anymore. In the New York Daily News, columnist Gersh Kuntzman, and if that name rings a bell, he's the guy who fired an AR-15 a couple days after Orlando, and he got PTSD, according to his own account, because he smelled the sulfur in the air, and he was just not right for a half an hour. So here's his ridiculous column for the New York Daily News. It's time for God to stop blessing America during the seventh inning stretch. Welcome to July 4th weekend, when once again baseball fans will be assaulted by the saccharine sweet non-anthem God Bless America at stadia all over this great land. But no matter which team you root for, God Bless America should be sent permanently to the bench. Part of my outrage stems from the ponderous Mussolini-esque introduction of the song when fans are asked to rise, remove their caps, and place them over their hearts. Reality check, friends. God Bless America is not the national anthem. The only songs Americans should stand for are the Star-Spangled Banner and Here Comes the Bride. Kate Smith asked Irving Berlin for a patriotic song for her radio show in 1938. He pulled out God Bless America. You know the rest. Smith's version became as much a symbol of post-war patriotism as the flag, the space program, and all the white people moving to the suburbs. The song still embodies great things about America, but also our worst things. Self-righteousness, forced piety, earnest self-reverence, and foam. And then he goes on to explain that the country is split between conservatives and liberals and whether they like the song. He reveals that he's an atheist, and so that's one of the reasons he obviously doesn't like it. Ian, the liberals are insistent on ruining sports. ESPN's doing an excellent job of that in their social coverage of everything that happens in sports nowadays. We can't just enjoy the game anymore. Everything's got to be a social commentary. And apparently we can't even sing God Bless America at the ballpark without enraging the left.
Yeah, first this guy goes after guns. Now he's going after God. It's just boatloads of fun. I really don't want Mr. Kuntzman at any party I would hold. First of all, I will admit I'm sympathetic to this one point, which is that God Bless America does have a sort of saccharine quality about it, and I'm entirely sympathetic to critique on musical grounds, which he attempts to do for a little bit of the column, but which is really only a guise for getting to the important thing, which is that you crazy baseball loving people who cling to God and guns need to stop this. This is something you see from less than five-star liberal columnists who take cultural moments and then impose on them their own progressive puritanism. It's so tiresome. The scolds of 50 years ago were old, creaky, elderly people. The scolds of today are young people who live in Greenwich. It's such an astonishing transformation. It's just extraordinary for someone like this columnist to write a column in which he criticizes baseball loving Americans who stand for God Bless America for being sanctimonious.
Oh, this is why we can't have nice things. I mean, the liberals just really won't let us enjoy anything anymore. It's just ridiculous how they have to infuse their agenda into absolutely everything, and even the finest of American traditions. What's next? The fireworks is like explosions in war, and that's what we're celebrating on the 4th,
okay,
so we can't have those either.
You know, Greg, you jest, but perhaps we should have raised this as well. Over at the Washington Post today at Wonk Blog, Christopher Ingram has a post about the lead is something like, thousands of you people are going to do a very stupid thing this weekend, and there's nothing anybody can do to stop you. And what he means is thousands of people are going to set off fireworks. Isn't this atrocious and dangerous? And why is it that the government can't come to the rescue and save people from their own stupidity? First of all, firework injuries and fatalities related to fireworks have gone down massively over the past couple decades, which is something that, you know, nobody acknowledges. But it's just, again, it's this nasty, snide, snobby tone, this scolding tone that these people exercise. You know, it's if you think, you know, fireworks are dangerous and you don't want people to do them, write that column. Why do you have to say it like, you lesser human beings who are less, you know, enlightened than I am, let me instruct you, as if, you know, the Washington Post's wonk blog was given by God directly down to Christopher Ingram on Mount Sinai. I mean, this is the MO of wonk blog and Vox and so many of these places now, and it's just tiresome. Let us live.
Exactly. It's just mocking everything that we love about America, and they just do it incessantly. I think the most depressing thing is I threw the fireworks thing out there as kind of an egregious example, almost an exaggeration of what they do, and it turns out to be true. They are going after it. I didn't even see that thing in the Post. My goodness.
It's the crazy martini. So, you know, if you can bring up the subject, we can definitely find an article related to it.
Amazing. Well, on that horrific note, Ian, have a wonderful 4th of July. I hope you set off a lot of fireworks. I hope you sing God Bless America if you go to the ballpark. And thank you very much, as always, for filling in for Jim.
Absolutely. And I plan to make liberals especially unhappy by grilling as many different types of meat as I can possibly find. So I hope listeners do the same.
Awesome. Ian Tuttle of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Jim and I will be back on Tuesday. No podcast on the 4th, but we'll be back on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.